As Enkidu enters Uruk, he is mobbed like a celebrity. He may be gigantic, he may have a savage past, but he is fully human now, and recognizing his innocence, people are not too frightened to approach him, as the trapper was. The crowds treat him with a mixture of awe and tenderness, marveling at his enormous body and kissing his enormous feet as if they were doting mothers kissing the most luscious morsels of infant flesh. Enkidu finds his way to the marriage house and plants himself in front of the door, immovable. When Gilgamesh arrives, the two heroes seize each other, butting heads like wild bulls, careening through the streets, crashing into walls, and making the houses tremble. The confrontation could hardly be more primal, stripped down to the element of male pride. Enkidu's anger is beside the point. There are no principles to be upheld, no justifications and counter-justifications. The battle is as silly as a schoolyard fight, yet there is something beautiful about its energy. There is also a deeply erotic element in it. This is not a fight to the death, as in the Iliad or Beowulf. It is a fight at the end of which each man will be able to say to his opponent, "Now I know you." Or even, as Jacob said to his angel, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." It is an entrance into intimacy, and as close to love-making as to violence. The poem comes just short of stating that the relationship between Gilgamesh and Enkidu is homosexual. In Tablet 12, a separate poem appended to the epic, the genital sexuality is explicit. But it's clear that the homoerotic element in their bond is very strong. Even before he meets Enkidu in combat, Gilgamesh dreams of him in an image of great physical tenderness. A boulder, representing Enkidu, falls from the sky. At first it is too heavy to budge, then it becomes the beloved in his arms, stone turning to warm flesh through the power of the metaphor. Gilgamesh's mother, in interpreting the dream, says that that is indeed how it will be, that the boulder stands for a dear friend, a mighty hero. You will take him in your arms, embrace and caress him the way a man caresses his wife. Both men come to feel their friendship as a kind of marriage, and each one could say, as David says of Jonathan, "Thy love to me is wonderful, passing the love of women." After the fight, Enkidu doesn't slink off or proffer his neck like an animal defeated by the alpha male. In a speech of the loveliest, most dignified humility, he acknowledges Gilgamesh as the superior fighter, the superior human being. In fact, he sees him with the eyes of appreciation, gazing at him in wonder as Shamhat had advised him to. "Gilgamesh, you are unique among humans. Your mother, the goddess Ninsun, made you stronger and braver than any mortal, and rightly has Enlil granted you the kingship, since you are destined to rule over men." Gilgamesh, as victor, doesn't feel the need to reciprocate with any appreciation of Enkidu, but he knows that what he dreamed at the end of Book One has come true. The dear friend and mighty hero has appeared, the longed-for companion of his heart, the man who will stand at his side through the greatest dangers. The fight is over without any residue of anger, resentment, or competitiveness. They know each other through and through. Like David and Jonathan, each loves the other as his own soul.